Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Eric Ray Buckley. He is president of the New Mexico Society of Acupuncture and Asian Medicine. Fike Duckworth is Acupuncturist of the Year for the American Association of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine and former vice chair of the Accreditation Commission for Acupuncture and Oriental Medical Schools in the United States. We're here to talk about Oriental medicine. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mayor Charlotte.
Hi, nice to be here.
Let's start with some basics. What are the fundamental principles of Oriental medicine? They're awfully different from the kind of medicine that's practiced when you go to a regular clinic and get a doctor with a stethoscope.
I always look at it as that Oriental medicine went after the energetics or the physics of the body, where Western medicine went after the chemistry. You have to have an energetic pattern, electrons, protons, all of those things that we studied way back when in high school in physics, and that is the basis of Oriental medicine, is the energy body. And that's what we treat, and that's what we manipulate with needles. I think that you can look at the body as an electrical grid, and that you want that grid to be energetically balanced. You don't want to be overcharged or undercharged. And so what Oriental practitioners do is that they diagnose your energy pattern. And for example, like a headache, that's an overcharge. So they want to reduce that charge. And that's putting in a little different framework than the yin and the yang. But I think you can look at that in terms of energy, positive energy and negative energy, positive charge, negative charge.
What is the yin and the yang?
The yin and the yang of the body is the positive and negative forces, the male and the female, the light and the dark. There's a lot of different ways of looking at it that are just the opposites in nature. And we maintain that health is arrived to through a balance, through the yin and the yang. And that is what we mostly practice. It's clinical homeostasis is what I like to call it. When you go to a normal doctor's office, they're not necessarily trying to balance your body as a whole. They're looking at symptoms and they're treating you symptomatically. And we treat the symptoms by treating the whole patient and balancing the body and getting it back into proper order. Homeostasis in Western medicine is something that you normally only hear about when you go to anatomy and physiology class in the very beginning of school, but then you never really hear about homeostasis again. So that's what we practice on a daily basis. And keeping the yin and the yang, also there's internal and external. There's heat and cold. And so with maintaining the balance between those opposites, that's how we keep the homeostasis and keep people healthy. And I think that's another thing that we do that's different than Western medicine, is that we are practicing maintaining health as opposed to treating sickness.
Although you certainly do treat sickness, otherwise people wouldn't generally come in.
Right. Well, we treat sickness by helping the body to maximize its potential through maximizing its health principles, and not through just treating one symptomatic disease.
Now, you treat through acupuncture, which is the sticking of little needles into the body in strategic places and either leaving them there or withdrawing them right away. You use herbs, sometimes you use dietary changes and things like that. Do you know how it is that somebody in ancient China several millennia ago discovered that when you punch a needle into a person, their health might improve?
Well, probably it was an evolution of first touching different parts of the body and getting an effect, and then maybe using heat, and then using needles. We know that needles weren't really made until the Iron Age. You have to have the metal processing. So probably originally it was more with touch and heat, which is moxibustion. Moxibustion is an herb that's lit and either run over the top of the skin or put on top of the needle. So probably it was done somewhat by experimentation with manual touch or heating first, and then the needles evolved. There's a very ancient book, it's about 4,000 years old, called The Yellow Emperor. And, you know, the story goes is that it was kind of a transmission to the Yellow Emperor, and that he came to understand the yin and the yang and the circulation of the elements, and that that's how it first developed. But that kind of jumps into the middle of the story, and there have never been found any texts prior to that to really delineate exactly who did what, when, and where.
Now, there's a great deal more known about the recent history of acupuncture, and there was a very great change that happened as a result of the Cultural Revolution.
During the Cultural Revolution in China, it was necessary to bring medicine to the masses because the Cultural Revolution in China was mostly a revolution that happened within the countryside and not within the cities like other Marxist revolutions had happened. So in order to bring medicine to the people that had brought the uprising against Chiang Kai-shek and have him, as they kicked him out to Taiwan, they utilized TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, to bring health to their people. And a lot of the methods were changed and abbreviated and made more simple so that it could be taught to a lot more people very quickly.
And so, as we were talking about before the show started, a kind of a barefoot doctor practice began. What does that mean?
Well, they were, you know, fairly desperate to have medical services out into the community, and so they developed what was called the barefoot doctor program and manual. And literally, you got very minimal training, and you were handed this manual, which had, you know, points, you know, acupuncture points and herbs, and they got people out because the people needed medical services.
So, you both are people who were born and raised in the United States, going to the doctor, taking Vicks Formula 44, whatever, when you had a cold, and aspirin, and all the kinds of things that you grow up with, and then you go to schools of Oriental medicine. I know that Eric Ray, you have had extensive. I mean, you've worked in St. Vincent's Hospital, and you have also, Fike, practiced various kinds of Western practices. How do you think about these things together? How do you think about Oriental medicine in terms of Western medicine and vice versa on a theoretical level?
I think the way that I approach it in general is that, like we were talking about the headache, if you have a headache, it means that the energy pattern went off first. You have to have a shift in the energy pattern to have a shift in the chemistry. And if you have a shift in the chemistry, you start a whole chemical cascade that causes pain, prostaglandins, for instance, and then you have a headache. So I don't see any kind of division between the two. I see it as a continuum, that the energy is the first thing, and it continues into the physical. And so if you go back to the source, basically, and treat the source, i.e. the energy problem, you're going to easily change the physical problem. There are situations like a horrible car accident where, you know, there's ripping and tearing and crushing and maiming. You have to then have Western medicine. Acupuncture is not going to put a broken leg back together.
Right. But then there are things like, for example, I have in my own life compared the efficacy of Chinese medicine and Western medicine in things like treating menstrual cramps. And they say, oh, you should take acupuncture and take herbs and all this stuff. And I do, and it doesn't work. And then I take two Advil, and we're done. They're completely over. What do you do with that? I mean, sometimes you treat symptoms, and it works, and it's cheap, and it's easy, and it's fast, and you're done.
Well, I think that there's different things that work for different people. There's a lot of people out there that don't want to take Advil because it has so many other side effects, especially in the gastrointestinal system. So maybe they have a delicate system when it comes to their bellies, and they actually will get better results from herbs and acupuncture. So it really just depends on what you want to do, and I think that that's where our medicine, and when I say our medicine, I mean everybody's medicine, is heading towards in general. And that's towards being more integrative and not really looking at what the science, or not what, not looking at what the actual method is that's used, but what works. And that's the important part. If somebody's having a heart attack, they're not going to go to their acupuncturist.
Right.
But if somebody's having back pain, I don't think you would want to go to a Western doctor first. I think you would want to come and see us.
Right.
Because we can give you relief from your back pain with having very few symptoms and not getting hooked on what some people would consider a doorway drug to many other types of more intense drugs. So, and I'm talking about any type of opiate medications, of course.
So back pain is one example. Tell me some of the other examples that each of you sees in your daily practice about what Chinese medicine is really good, Oriental medicine is really good at healing.
Well, I think that something that's almost epidemic in this country right now is IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. And I treat, I can't tell you how many patients every week with this because of diet problems, etc. If you go to a Western doctor, they really can't do much for you, where the acupuncture seems to be extremely effective in turning it around fairly quickly and actually getting rid of it. So in that example, I would say, you know, go to Eastern.
So when you treat, for example, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, are you giving people mainly herbs? Are you changing their diet? Are you giving them needles? How does it...
Needles first. They have to change their diet usually. Usually there's something in their diet that's very irritating them. So you have to discover that. And then I also give them herbs. And the herbs are kind of like to keep the lid on things until the body can actually heal and then stand on its own.
There's this idea that you're both talking about, that the body, perhaps when you are a child or the healthy body, works just fine. Do you encounter people whose basic healthy body is just flawed? They're both nodding.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we all come in with our own energetic pattern and our own genetics, and acupuncture cannot take you beyond your genetics. So you have to live with your genetics. I think the trick is not to play into the weaknesses that you have, but to learn about those genetics and what kind of pitfalls there might be in your health and stay away from those. Sometimes diet, exercise. Someone whose family has diabetes shouldn't be eating a lot of sugar, and they should be exercising pretty rigorously and regularly. So you don't have to play into it. You can, you know, design your life, have a strategy, a health strategy to not get diabetes. And I think that acupuncture really helps that, and I also think it helps get the in this case it would be the pancreas, working as strongly as it possibly can. Can't go beyond its genetic pattern, but you can potentiate that pancreas function so that they're less likely to end up being a diabetic.
We're talking to Fike Duckworth and Eric Ray Buckley about Oriental medicine. What about patterns, and this also seems to have at least some genetic component, of addiction? People are addicted to drugs, to alcohol, to all sorts of crazy things. How can, if it can, Oriental medicine help people who have those problems?
Oh, there's a fabulous, fabulous protocol called the NADA protocol, and it's an ear acupuncture.
NADA, N-A-D-A?
N-A-D-A. Don't ask me what it stands for because I don't think I can pull it up right now. And it's an ear acupuncture, and it was originally invented by Dr. Brad Smith in Brooklyn. And he was working with heroin addicts, and it is to help the brain chemistry rebalance itself. And so it mimics the cascade of endorphins and serotonin and dopamine in the brain by stimulating these points in the ears. And they've actually done research and shown in, you know, blood analysis that all of these neurotransmitters actually come up. And part of what's going on with addiction is that you get that cascade by getting high. And so when you stop using, your body is like, I want that, I want that. And so the addict heads back to the drug because it's got the brain's gotten so out of balance. So by putting the needles in, it stimulates that chemical response in the brain so that they don't want to race out and get the drug. And then slowly the receptors calm down, you know, for the heroin, and they can get off of it.
Does the ear acupuncture make you high?
Well, to a certain extent, but then so does chocolate. Chocolate has cannabinoids in it, and that's why a lot of people eat it, and they feel so good after eating it. And so it's basically stimulating the neurotransmitters.
Yeah, and there is a long period of relaxation that accompanies the needles. Usually the needles are put in and left for about 45 minutes. So after that time of just going inward and being at peace and being at rest and letting the needles do their work, people will come out with a different sense than they went in.
Absolutely. It's very interesting. The times that I have had this reaction myself, you can have been in a horrible headspace for 6 weeks, and then you get an acupuncture session, which is about 45 minutes long, and you just come out a different person. It's very strange.
Yeah.
And it's hard to understand. Maybe you guys understand it physiologically, what the brain chemical component of that is.
Well, it actually stimulates those neurotransmitters to raise up in level, which then goes sit in your receptors, and that makes... I mean, it's a very thin line between happy and unhappy, and it's a lot of chemistry. And I don't think people understand that. I think when you see someone who has Alzheimer's, their brain chemistry is failing. Parkinson's, same thing. Their brain chemistry is failing. If you can rebalance that brain chemistry, and you can do it with needles, you can also do some of it with pharmaceuticals. And
can you prevent Alzheimer's or stop it in its tracks?
I don't know if you can prevent it. It depends. I mean, you'd have to get a hold of the patient very early in life, because we now know it's aberrant proteins that attack the brain and destroy the actual brain white matter. It actually eats holes in it. And so...
Yeah, there's no putting that back.
You can't put that back.
You can't put
the genie back in the bottle.
No, but you can build different pathways. Yeah. And I think that's what a lot of what we work on when we're working with people and resetting the body is that we're actually helping people to burn different pathways within their bodies to allow themselves to get to a spot that is out of the habitual nature where they have been before. So if you want to talk about addiction, or if you want to talk about just a chronic illness that has been with somebody for a long time, you're getting the body to respond to its environment in a different way, and therefore burning different pathways within the brain and within our own body chemistry and arriving at healing in a different way completely.
One of the things that is interesting about Eastern medicine versus Western is that the Western paradigm is on finding standards, whereas Oriental medicine seems to take each person as an individual, and let's say I've got a thyroid problem, what works for me might be completely different than what works for somebody else who also has a thyroid problem.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was just recently at MD Anderson Cancer Center at their integrative medicine program for a week, and that's a cancer center in Houston, Texas, and they... that cancer center is doing a lot of research on the different manifestations of cancer. And it will be the same type of cancer, but with different people. And they're showing that there's a genetic makeup to the different cancers that will manifest, like you can take non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and you can have several different varieties of that, depending upon the person and their genetic makeup. And so Western medicine normally has been taking that way of looking at the body, of a textbook way of everybody's pretty much the same, and you just apply this drug or apply this treatment, and it works the same for everybody. But this new research that they're doing is showing that that's not necessarily true. And they're actually coming around to seeing that medicine can be individualistic and isn't necessarily one size fits all. And then on the opposite of that is that a lot of acupuncture research is looked at in trying to get protocols for certain ailments, and it's trying to take a standard cookbook treatment and then apply it to everybody and say that you can do this treatment over and over again and it will work for everybody.
Like the NADA treatment for heroin addicts.
Like the NADA treatment for heroin addicts. Yeah, and it doesn't always work for everyone. And, you know, so there's lines that are crossing in both directions. We definitely, acupuncture and oriental medicine definitely looks at individual manifestations. The same headaches, we look at headaches and it will be a different manifestation for two different people or for four different people. Same with IBS. Western medicine looks at IBS, everybody has the same kind of symptoms, so it's very interesting.
So when you individualize a treatment for somebody, you're looking at their yin-yang, you're feeling their pulses, you're looking at whether this is a skinny little waif of a person or a big, huge, robust person, and that will determine or partially determine how you treat them, even if they have the same disease as somebody else.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think you have to take the whole picture and figure out what is the root cause and try to treat that, because a symptom, when you finally get a symptom manifesting, it means that the problem's probably been there for a while. So you really need to kind of, it's like unwinding a ball of string and trying to get back to what started it and treat that. And when you treat the root cause, not only does the symptom goes away, they usually don't get it back. And so that's a big difference.
Yeah, and you also treat the symptom at the same time, too,
yeah.
Because you want them to get some relief. But there's, as Fike said, there's a lot of time that's probably gone into the manifestation of a certain disease for the patient. And so, therefore, you know, it takes time to get that patient out of it, too. A lot of people will come and they'll get one treatment and they'll say, oh, well, that didn't work for me. And that's not how acupuncture and oriental medicine works. You need to take time and you need to work with your practitioner in order to get to your desired goals. It's not a one-size-fits-all, you know, just a pill in a bottle kind of answer or solution.
We're talking to Eric Ray Buckley and Fike Duckworth, doctors of oriental medicine. What about really major deadly diseases like cancer? You know, somebody comes in, they've got third stage brain cancer, something like that, and it's been recommended that they have surgery. When you say it's taken a long time for a symptom to have manifested in that way, okay, that's a long time. They've got this thing the size of a ping pong ball in their head. What role does acupuncture and oriental medicine play?
I would say that it plays very well for symptom management when it comes to helping people deal with the very heavy-duty side effects of their treatment that they're going to be undergoing when they're getting chemotherapy or radiation. In China and in Asia in general, there is a lot of herbal medicine that is utilized for the treatment of cancer, but in the United States, we don't necessarily do that because there's some legal gray areas. So we've been mostly, I guess you could say, pigeonholed into just treating the symptoms that are associated with the treatment of cancer, even though there is other possibilities that are outside of that realm.
Well, let's say somebody comes to you and they say, it turns out that I've got what's called a very, very grave cancer. I don't have health insurance. I can't afford the chemotherapy, the radiation, all of that stuff. Are there functional treatments that could actually put the thing into remission?
I wouldn't be able to talk to that because I always say you got to go to the oncologist. I think that if you have something like a stage 3 cancer, that person has limited time to get in front of it. And acupuncture is going to take the slow way, and chemo is the fast way. It just goes in and kills it. And it doesn't always work. I mean, chemo isn't always a foolproof situation either. There's lots of cancer victims that take chemo, and it still gets them. But with acupuncture, with stage 3, wouldn't even touch it.
And we're back with Fike Duckworth and Eric Ray Buckley talking about acupuncture and oriental medicine. Another component that I think is very important to talk about is diet. Doctors seem to not really be trained in nutrition as a path toward health, as both as a medicine and as a way of preventing ill health. What do you guys have to say about nutrition? Again, is it something which is different for every person? Are there some guidelines that people can follow?
Absolutely, it's different for every person, and it's fundamental to people's health and well-being. It's not something that can be thought of as a secondary way of going about through your daily existence. It needs to be something that's primary. You are what you eat, and if you eat garbage, you're going to feel poor pretty much all the time. And, of course, when we're young and when our bodies have a high capacity of healing themselves, we can get away with a lot. But as we age and as we get older, things get compromised after abusing ourselves for time and time again, and things will start to break down. That absolutely is inevitable. And diet and lifestyle choices are the way that people can change their own individual health in a fundamental way. And it's not easy, but it's what is necessary to really make those substantial changes in the body's chemistry.
How do people start? In other words, I say, okay, I really love Fritos. And I really love Oreo cookies. And I grew up eating, basically, personally, chocolate milk, Oreo cookies, Fritos, and then whatever actual real food my parents gave me, which consisted of a lot of hamburgers and hot dogs and things like that. And then you grow up and you find out that you've got all these little ailments and you're trying to... So but where do you start? Do you go to an acupuncturist and say, I want to change my diet. Can you feel my yins and yangs and pulses and look at my head and tell me what to eat? I mean, how does, you know?
Yes. You can diagnose a patient and figure out what their kind of baseline constitution. Are they a liver type? Are they a spleen type? And that basic kind of diagnosis does determine what they should and shouldn't eat. If you're a liver person, you should not be drinking a lot of alcohol. It damages the liver, and that is your kind of constitution, and so you don't want to do that.
A liver person means they have a weak liver?
They tend to have a weak liver. They're going to tend to show liver kinds of symptoms or be affected by liver kinds of foods or the wind, that kind of thing. So there's the whole complex. So Oriental medicine, when they diagnose somebody, doesn't just look at, oh, you have a headache. It's going to look at the whole body. What does your skin look like? What are your eyes like? You know, what's your speech type? Mm-hmm. What do you eat currently? As well as taking pulses and that, you know, more definitive kind of thing.
Now, are there any basic guidelines that are good for everybody in terms of diet?
Yes. The first thing I would tell people is you should look at how acidic your diet is. More and more research has come out. I mean, in Oriental medicine, that's been a given for thousands of years. But I think that the West is just now coming to it. Eric and I had breakfast with Andrew Weil and his, you know, new book, and his whole thrust with his integrative medical program is about a lot about diet and lifestyle change. And part of it is that if you're eating a very, very acidic diet, acid degrades, acid etches, acid, you know, can cause disintegration.
Of your stomach lining?
Your joints. What is diabetes but high blood sugar? Sugar is one of the most acidic things that you can eat. And it will, if you have high blood sugar, it will actually dissolve your blood vessels, which is why diabetics lose toes and eyesight and have heart failure, is that it actually destroys the blood vessels.
So acidic foods, we're talking about orange juice and tea and then coffee?
Sugar, too much red meat. Red meat's a prime suspect.
Alcohol
turns into sugar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a lot of inflammation that happens within the body as a response to these different foods. And just to pin it back to cancer, there's a lot of research that is looking at the inflammation process as a mechanism directly towards causing cancer within the body. So if you want to talk about the cancer prevention, the first and main thing is to not eat these different things. And, of course, that's a gradual thing that somebody that has been brought up, like you were saying, with the cookies and chocolate milk, you know, it's like, tell me to stop eating sugar. What? How am I going to do that? It's not something that you have to just do cold turkey. It's something that is a matter of gradual shifts.
Well, yeah. I mean, I once went, I actually was talking to you, BK, years ago, and my mother has terrible arthritis, and I was beginning to feel some sensation in my joints, and I said, you know, what can I do in terms of diet? And you said, well, give up red meat, sugar, alcohol, nightshades and coffee. And I think I said to you at the time, look, I'm Italian. Those are the five food groups.
Yes.
But in fact, over the course of about 5 years, I did that, and all the joint pain is gone.
That's right.
And that's the thing, is that over a course of time, you made changes in a gradual and positive direction. And that's where people, I think, get lost, is they feel like they need to do everything right now because we're so caught up in this disposable and momentary, immediate gratification. That's not what it's all about. It's about making subtle changes.
Well, in terms of the concept of homeostasis that you began with, I would think that changing everything overnight would kind of mess with your homeostasis.
Absolutely, absolutely. And another thing that they've brought up, or the new theories that doctors bring up, is eating a lot of vegetables, especially green leafy vegetables. And it's gotten to the point now where they say to 9 to 11 servings of vegetables a day. That's what
Who eats 9 times
who
a day?
Who could eat that?
9 to 11 servings of vegetables a day. I know.
That's
I was
silly.
Blown away
That's
by
just,
it, too.
When they say stuff like that, you just want to say, okay, let me just die young because I can't do that.
Well, I think that that goes back to not eating large portion meals, so not having a lot of food in one sitting, eating smaller portions. And when they talk about a portion, they're not talking about having your whole plate full. They're talking about the palm of your hands.
Okay,
Yeah, so that would be, a very small sample. Now, getting that into your diet over the course of a day, of course, it's a very difficult task. But to get to that point, that's the ideal, 9 to 11 servings. I don't even eat that.
There is something comical about that.
I think that, when we talk about things like cancer prevention, people kind of go, well, I'm never going to get cancer. But I think that what people need to realize is that your major chronic degenerative diseases are almost all linked to inflammation, which then links back to what Eric was talking about, things like sugar and too much meat. We know that osteoporosis absolutely is tied to overconsumption of protein and sugar, and that it degrades your bones. Same thing with arthritis. What is arthritis? It is a degenerative process of your joints to where sometimes you're going to be immobilized in your later years. Eating a proper diet can really, really, really minimize this. There are genetic components, of course, with something like arthritis, but again, it's like eat away from it, potentialize your better side rather than getting the genes all stirred up.
We're talking to Fike Duckworth and Eric Ray Buckley about Oriental medicine. So how much has Oriental medicine, when I was a child, I don't think I heard of acupuncture, the very concept, the word did not enter my vocabulary. Never heard of it. Now, in places like Santa Fe, there's so many acupuncturists that you don't even know where to start in the Yellow Pages, and even smaller cities across the U.S. now have acupuncturists and Oriental medicine. But to what extent has it entered the mainstream in terms of insurance taking it and in terms of being respected and referrals going back and forth with doctors? I mean, you were saying you refer people to doctors all the time. Do doctors refer people to you?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yes. I think when we start talking about integration, I think it's happening. It's not some future thing that's going to happen. It is happening and has happened. Acupuncture and Oriental medicine has been covered by insurance since 1988. And
to a greater or lesser extent.
A minimum 75% of my practice is insurance.
Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. All the major insurers in this state cover acupuncture. All car insurance. If you get in a car accident, you are covered. You can go to an acupuncturist and be treated for whiplash or bruising or this or that, because it is mandated by state law that car insurance has to cover acupuncture.
And also workman's compensation, too.
Yeah, that's what workman's comp also covers acupuncture. So it is something that can be easily utilized. And there are sometimes policies where you know, acupuncture and chiropractic and stuff has been excluded, but that's usually been excluded by the employer who's buying the insurance or by the individual. For the most part, you can find an insurance policy that covers alternative and complementary medicine, with the exception, of Medicare. And this is just one of my biggest campaigns right now. I think the fact that Medicare does not cover Oriental medicine and is then consequently not accessible by our elderly community is age discrimination. It's like you can get Oriental medicine covered by your insurance company up until you turn 65 and you have to go on Medicare, and suddenly you're not covered. And not only does Medicare not cover it, but your supplementary insurance won't cover it because Medicare doesn't cover it.
Yeah.
This is, and it's kind of tragic because your older people are much more sensitive to pharmaceutical drugs. Their liver function is starting to slow down. So pharmaceuticals tend to build up in their system. They don't clear as well. They're often on multiple medications because of pain and this and that. And pretty soon you've got a cocktail going with the patient becoming almost disabled. And
they're most vulnerable or more vulnerable to back problems, which is, at the
Absolutely.
Beginning you were saying was some one of the things that's best cured by acupuncture.
Right. And so why Medicare wouldn't cover our older population is a little beyond me, because it would reduce significantly things like pharmaceutical prescriptions and a lot of medical procedures. There was just recently a study by Rand Corporation called it's Rand Health, and the researcher was Andrew Dick, and they did a statistical analysis of 17,000 medical and drug claims. And what the study found was that acupuncture use does not affect the utilization of other medical services and pharmaceuticals. Specifically, acupuncture substituted for primary care, all outpatient services, pathological services, all surgeries and gastrointestinal medications. And that this is happening.
It's substituted for
it. It's substituted.
So in other words, your primary care physician could be an acupuncturist.
Correct. And that the use of the expenditure in acupuncture does not increase insurance costs. It actually decreases the cost of other medical services.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you next, was the economics of all this. So when an insurance company offers a really good acupuncture plan to its people, to what extent does that reduce the number of claims? In other words, you know, let's say I get $1,000 worth of acupuncture in a year, am I saving the insurance company $10,000 because all these diseases are not manifesting in the first place?
In this study, that was exactly what was shown, is that the use of acupuncture offset or reduced other medical claims.
Very interesting.
So,
and we see that in our clinic on a daily basis. You know, I have patients that come in that are candidates for back surgery, and then after a couple of treatments are no longer candidates for back surgery. And, you know, you might have to keep up with that patient, especially if they're, an older patient. You might have to keep up with maintenance. You know, you're not seeing them twice a week. You maybe now are seeing them once a month or once every couple weeks or something like that. In the beginning, you're seeing them a lot. But after a while, you get to that maintenance stage, and, you know, you've saved people a lot of money from not going into back surgery, and also a lot of potential complications that could end up with the patient in the hospital, infections. Back surgery isn't 100% that it will always work. So
all those weird diseases with resistant strain bacteria that you get in hospitals and die from.
MRSA, yes.
How do the back surgeons feel about this?
Well, I think that you would find that most back surgeons, their last option is surgery. Mm-hmm. It is very invasive. It isn't 100%, and they'll tell you that. You know, when you go in to talk to a surgeon, they're going to tell you, this can help. It may not take the pain away. We might be able to remove that disc and nothing else will happen. I mean, there's no guarantees with back surgery. So a surgeon always starts off with things like, go have some acupuncture, go do some physical therapy.
A good surgeon.
Let's do some epidurals. They'll try everything butt surgery. So they're actually, I think, very happy and very pleased if that patient doesn't have to have surgery.
Yeah, and it's not like I haven't seen patients that have come in and acupuncture didn't work for. There are certain people that it is not the solution, and they actually are surgical candidates. So, and I think that's where the integration comes in, and that communication between the primary surgeon and the doctors of oriental medicine is essential, because we can really save the system money, and we can also give patients better options.
Now, the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, has research going on acupuncture.
Yes, there's probably currently, right today, over 20 trials happening. Acupuncture with asthma, acupuncture with back pain, you know. They are really, really studying this because they're finding more and more how effective it is, and so they're trying to document it so that it gains more and more acceptance. And it's somewhat tricky to do controlled trials, because you have this thing called blinding, and it's very hard to blind a patient and pretend they're getting acupuncture.
You know? Right.
Yeah, it's very hard.
Is a needle
tricky.
Sticking into me or not?
Right, and for a while they were doing controls by putting the needle not on the point, but just to the side of the point, you know. But anytime you insert a needle anywhere on the body, it immediately starts releasing the body chemistry of endorphins and polypeptides. So you're going to get some kind of effect. So
even if it's not on the supposedly correct point, and that messes up your study.
That's
hilarious.
Right. Yes. Yeah. But it's just like surgery. How do you have a blinded surgery?
Yeah.
How do you have a patient go in and pretend that they've had surgery?
Yeah, right.
So there's no controls in surgery. So this acupuncture kind of has that same problem in that it is invasive, and you are putting something into the body, just like a surgeon's putting a knife in. It's pretty hard to pretend.
Yeah, and they also were doing it where they wouldn't put the needle through the point. They would have a needle that made the patient think that they were getting the needle into the point, but it actually just hit the surface of the skin.
But that probably has an effect, too.
That also has an effect, because there are complete schools of acupuncture that are based upon non-invasive or non-insertion.
Like acupressure.
Like acupressure, sure, yeah. And certain styles of Japanese acupuncture. So, you know, and they would call that sham acupuncture, but unfortunately it's really not a sham. It's the same as some treatment methods.
I think also, I mean, we talked a little while ago about how certain protocols are developed for certain things, but the whole idea of doing a double-blind Western study is to come up with statistics of what happens to most people, but as we've talked about at some length, Oriental medicine is individualized to the person, and how do you study over a large pool of people something which is not about symptoms, but which is individualized to the whole system of that person?
Yeah,
that's exactly right. And I think the double-blind is starting to be called into question more and more.
Yeah, and at MD Anderson, they were doing single-blind studies, yeah, which are supposedly just as valid of
studies.
What
does that mean? The patient doesn't know, but the doctor does?
Yes.
So what makes a good acupuncturist? I know that some people really want to go in and just get attention. They want to be listened to, and some people want to go in no nonsense and just get in, get out, nobody gets hurt, kind of not have it be a sort of therapy session with this person. What makes a good practitioner?
I think that the most important thing that a practitioner, either Eastern or Western, is that you, when you interact with the patient, you meet them where they are, that you're not trying to overlay onto them a grid of scientific or philosophy or anything, but that you actually, like you just said, some patients really want to talk, some patients don't. The practitioner has to be in a place where he or she can accept that. This patient doesn't want to talk, and that's okay. That patient needs to talk, that's okay. But that you access the patient where they are, not where you are. If you have a patient that's having a lot of difficulty understanding something like blood sugar, you have to get to a place where they understand. You have to get the vocabulary that will transmit the ideas so that they can really grasp a hold of it and put it into their lives. Otherwise, you're just talking to the air. It won't help.
Even if you do a good treatment.
Well, yes, but it's very hard to do a good treatment if you're not syncing with the patient. You really have to sync with the patient and feel where their energy is, not where your energy is. So you can't come in all, you know, buzzed out on coffee or something, because you will get static. You will not be able to feel their energy appropriately or clearly. You have to be able to go into a space where when you touch that person, you're touching their energy and you're not bringing in your energy or some other kind of thought process. You really have to read them.
And so you kind of get out of your own way. Is that something that can be taught? I mean, you work with the accreditation organization and you look at schools. Is that something that people are teaching?
Yes. They teach it through Tai Chi. They teach it through meditation. They teach it through Qigong. I think there's a variety of ways. And I think that Eastern medicine really addresses that pretty effectively. And I think it's something that Western medicine is starting to look at in medical schools, is that you have to get a little bit more quiet to hear your patient. You can't come in all, you know, predisposed. It just, you'll miss it. You'll miss what's wrong, and you'll miss what the patient's saying to you.
Yeah, and I think that's also important, and you need to have somebody that has a very empathic nature. And a lot of Western medicine has been missing out on that empathy. And has been more of a one-way relationship where the doctor is the authority and they tell the patient just exactly what it is that they need to do in order to get to the patient's goals. And this is more of a little bit of a give and take. It's more of an education. It's a conversation. It's not a lecture. And that is really important in the patient-doctor relationship in order to help the patient understand what exactly it is that they need to do and know that you're on their side.
And although there is a funny thing that's happened that I've noticed in Western medicine lately, that you will have doctors saying to you, so what do you want to do?
Huh.
And you never know.
There was a few years back, there was a very interesting article in the Wall Street Journal. And what it talked about this very thing, and one of the reasons that has started to happen is that so many people go on the internet and get information, and they come to their doctors and they say, well, how about we try this, or how about we do this, or blah blah blah.
And they also probably have a commercial or two of a drug that they've seen.
And yeah, the commercialization of pharmaceuticals, I think, is definitely playing into this.
Although I can't believe that works, because you see these things on TV and somebody's running through a field of flowers and the voiceover is saying, this may cause convulsions, your hair falling out, sickness, nausea, death, losing your feet, and you will be happy.
Yeah, there's a little disconnect there. I also think that the medical system in general suffers from too much litigation. And so if the doctor says to you, well, what do you want to do, and you pick it, then he didn't prescribe it.
Ah. Mm.
And so there's a legal safety net in there, and then you'll often see in notes now from Mayo's Clinic, et cetera, the patient came in and said, I think I should have a lobotomy, you know. And the doctor kind of goes, do you really think you should have a lobotomy? And the patient says, yes. If that patient then goes ahead and has a lobotomy, the doctor has a lot less legal responsibility there.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we've been talking about acupuncture and oriental medicine with Fee K. Duckworth, who received the award of Acupuncture of the Year, Acupuncturist of the Year, with the American Association of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine, and Eric Ray Buckley, who is the president of the New Mexico Society of Acupuncture and Asian Medicine. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.